Thanks for listening to KPFT, Houston.
We will control all that you see and hear.
This is Future Primitive, and you can hear us each and every late Saturday night, early Sunday morning on 90.1 FM, KPFT, Houston, with your host, Spiscal Music and ST606, and our monthly resident, Ambient Massive, bringing you the best of the Ambient Acid Show each and every month. We bring you the best in downtempo, jungle, drum and bass, breakbeat, and so much more. So please tune in every late Saturday night, early Sunday morning for Future Primitive to bring in your Sunday mornings on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Yeah, my name is Paul. You're listening to KPFT Houston.
You're listening to Queer Voices on KPFT Houston. My name is Brett Cullum. I am hosting tonight's episode. First up, we have executive producer Brian Lavinka. He is talking to Brianna from Legacy Community Health. They are having an event at their wellness bar on Westheimer. Then I talk with Clara Zieglerova about her design work for the Alley's latest production, The Girl on the Train. This is their summer chill show, and it starts on July 24th. And they have an act out night on August 6th. Then I talk with author R. Lee Ingalls and poet Stelina Villarreal about their appearances at the Houston LGBTQ Plus Independent Author Fair at the Montrose Center on Saturday, August 1st from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. And finally, Matthew Williams continues our coverage of A Nice Indian Boy that opens at Asia Society Texas on Friday, July 31st. He talks with Tahir Lokhandwala about what brings him joy. Queer Voices starts now.
This is Brian Lavinka, and today on Queer Voices, we're interviewing someone from Legacy Community Health about an event coming up, and that is Brianna. Welcome to the show, Brianna.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So what is this event that you're having?
So this event is called Community or Cocktails in Community. It's an event that we have at Wellness Bar. This is our second annual event. We hosted it one last year, and it's really an event and an opportunity for the community members to learn more about Wellness Bar, for us to connect, to engage, and to really have meaningful conversations around health, wellness, community. And it really reflects on our belief for a strong community and really takes engaged approach to ensure that we kind of help our community for Health Beyond Care.
So what is Wellness Bar and where is it exactly?
Yeah, so Wellness Bar is located in Montrose. We're right on Westheimer. And Wellness Bar is a part of Legacy, a health center that was created for services such as HIV prevention, HIV testing, STI testing, sexual health services, and really just HIV treatment overall for the community that we're in.
So I thought HIV was over. I mean, what are we testing for? I mean, these days, is that still a thing?
It is still a thing. HIV is not over. Unfortunately, we do see that new testing and positive testing for HIV is still fairly high, especially in our Houston area. So definitely not over, and definitely still want to have a preventative approach, right? We do want our community to get tested because knowing your status is very important.
So you mentioned prevention. What does that mean exactly for HIV?
So for HIV, prevention means going to see your provider, getting tested, getting PrEP. So we do offer PrEP services also at our Wellness Bar location.
And what is PrEP?
So PrEP is going to be medication that you could take that will help you, will help you prevent HIV or contracting HIV.
It's pre-exposure prophylaxis.
Yes.
I knew the answer to the question, but I wanted to ask. I think this is a good time to disclose that I'm on the board of Legacy. So I'm doing this as a way to get information out about a Legacy. I believe in the organization and what they do, what we do, actually. So, Brianna, how did you get involved with Legacy?
So I got involved with Legacy about a year and maybe 4 months ago, was really looking to join an organization that really had a mission of doing what's right, making sure that community has quality care, and that really feels that healthcare is a right, right? Whether you have the ability to pay, which Legacy has that mission. So was really excited to join Legacy to really live out and contribute to a mission like this.
Yeah, I mean, Legacy does not turn anyone away. So anyone can come and get healthcare any time of the day, anywhere, anything that they need. So what have you learned about Legacy that you didn't expect?
Oh, that's a really great question. I learned about legacy that we do have funding or grant funding, especially for our patients with HIV. So the Ryan White grant funding. I guess when I first joined Legacy, I wasn't expecting us to have access to so much grant funding, even though we're FQHC, which is a federally funded, you know, organization. I think the amount of grants that we get, I wasn't expecting that. So really great to see us have those resources available.
Okay, you mentioned FQHC and Ryan White. What is Ryan White?
So Ryan White is grant funding that we receive to care for our HIV patients. Ryan White, I want to say, I can't remember right off the top of my head the story behind that, but I do know it is grant funding that we get from our...
He was a teenager in the 90s that passed away from HIV from a blood transfusion because he was he required that for his medical needs.
Thank you. Yes. I was going to say, I know it was the story behind it, but I didn't want to incorrectly kind of speak to the story.
So his story now saves thousands of lives across the country, across the world.
Yes. Yes.
So tell me more about this event.
Yes. So this event is going to be held on Friday, July 24th, and it is from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. And again, it is at our Wellness Bar location. That address is 120 Westheimer Road, Houston, Texas, 77006. And honestly, everyone should attend. We have staff members attending. Our providers are attending. We have our colleagues from nearby locations that are attending. And we really want our community members to come out. Any supporters, any partners, any of our community partners as well should come out to this event. And it, like I said, it's really just to engage in meaningful conversations around health, wellness, and really engage on how we can create a space that our community really loves to come get their health care from.
I know when they created the Wellness Bar, they created it as a way to get a kind of way from the clinic environment where there were like maybe kids or other sick people. And there was just kind of a way to get in and see your, get your provider and get your medicine in an environment that was more welcoming than a massive clinic.
Agreed. So the Wellness Bar atmosphere is very relaxing. And that was done on purpose. That was intentional. We wanted the Wellness Bar to really feel, again, more relaxed than your normal clinic. And it's really to kind of make our patients feel comfortable, because feeling comfortable and making sure our provider and our clinic is approachable is really that step or that barrier. It kind of breaks down the barrier to healthcare and really the stigma of it all, or the fear or the discomfort. So the Legacy team was very intentional about making that space very relaxing and very comfortable.
So for people that are on the fence about getting tested, what would you tell them?
I would tell them, don't be afraid. We're here to help, right? And knowing your status is definitely going to be powerful. Our teams are there to help you. We're welcoming. We will greet you with a smile on our face. But definitely take that first step and give us a chance to come in and really show you that healthcare is not that scary.
Brianna, I appreciate you coming on and talking about the Wellness Bar and the event happening at the Wellness Bar. Give me the date and give me the website too.
Absolutely. That date again is Friday, July 24th. And the time is 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. And then our website is, let me scroll up so I don't get it wrong. It's wellnessbarbylegacy.org.
That's easy to remember.
Yes.
Now, Brianna, is there anything that you want your listeners to know before we go?
Really just want our listeners to know that Legacy is here to provide quality care to all, not only just Wellness Bar, but we really partner with the other Legacy clinics as well to make sure we take care of the whole person. And it's really about health beyond care, taking care of the whole person. So please, if you have a chance and you're free, stop by, come check us out, and we'll be more than welcoming to you.
Well, thank you for coming on, and this is Queer Voices.
Thank you.
Hi there, this is Brett Cullum, and Clara Ziegler-Rova is the scenic designer for the Allie's Summer Chills production of The Girl on the Train. The show opens on July 24th. It runs through August 30th. there is going to be a special ACT OUT performance specifically for the LGBTQIA plus audience on August 6th. The show stars resident company member Elizabeth Bunch, who is fresh off killing and ultimately being killed by her husband in misery. The Girl on the Train was a DreamWorks film and a book by Paula Hawkins from 2015. So welcome, Clara.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, the first thing, this is one of the few works that I have not read the book. I have not seen the movie. Usually when we do the Summer Chills, it's like Agatha Christie, and I've read it like three or four times and all that. So this is going to be a mystery for me. So tell me, what is the story about?
So I had to confess, I actually haven't read the book either, and I have not seen the film. Probably one of the few people left in the world.
We're in the same boat.
We're in the same boat. I'm actually glad I didn't. I sometimes feel like it doesn't. Then I start fresh just on this, you know, with the story. It's a murder mystery. It's a thriller. It's a modern thriller. The main character, Rachel, is sort of an unreliable narrator. She has a history of substance abuse, and she's trying to figure out what happened, what she witnessed off a train. So she's a commuter into London, and she spends a lot of time on the train, and she's observing what happens in the people's backyards, and she witnesses something, or she thinks she witnesses something. She's not sure whom she saw, when she saw them, etc. So that's kind of what unravels as the story continues. It's a pretty wonderful. Hopefully it's going to be pretty wonderful progression, but it's a great story, really fun.
Well, considering that you've never read the book and you've never seen the movie, so how did you approach the set for this one? Because are you just taking the cues from the script immediately?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, there are so many different locations.
Yes.
She's on the train. We are in Rachel's home. We are in multiple other homes. And everything happens in a very quick sequence. So it's almost has this filmic, cinematic quality. So for me, I think one of my main job was to, how do you do that with the set? So you go very flawlessly from one scene to another. So that's especially at the Hubbard Theater, which is a thrust, which is a wonderful configuration for the audience, because there's not a bad seat in the house. Everybody has a really good view. But how do you get the furniture, people have to sit, things happen, onto the middle of the stage? That's always the tricky bit for me. So, in general, like when I read the script and I feel like, okay, I have a feeling this is how, for me, that's how it feels. We want to go to a very modern, I was very, very fortunate to work at the Alley before. I designed, Ken Ludwig's lent me a soprano. I worked on the murder of Roger Ackroyd, Agatha Christie, very traditional, wonderful, wonderful murder mysteries. And this time it's a little bit different. It's modern. It's kind of slick. And it's this girl, on the train. And, when you are on the train and you look out of the window, I have a very clear view, but then it gets darker. And actually the window turns into a mirror, and you see yourself, and then sometimes you see a little bit of the outside when it's lit, and that whole kind of mystery of what's inside, what's outside, again, being maybe under influence of substances, you don't quite know the realities. So that was kind of like, in general, the feel I was going after. So going back to the furniture, that's always the challenge. How do you, because if you have a proscenium theater, you can have sort of track and goes in and out pretty quickly. But if you have a thrust, so you have to be able to have the furniture go down, that track takes a long time. You kind of see it coming. And so we had a few different evolutions with the director. We were looking at turntable and bringing it, but it seemed like we were kind of locking ourselves in, because there's so many scene changes and it felt like repetitive. And then we thought, oh, what if you do? And this was so funny, because I talked to the technical director here, Paul Zappone. I said, what do you think about pop-ups? And he's like, pop-up what? And I said, oh, pop. And he said, when something like it's a floor and kind of just comes up, he said, oh, you mean toasters? And I said, so it's funny how the terminology for theater design is, every region, I guess. So we are doing some toasters. That means that the furniture kind of miraculously rises from the floor. That allows for a very smooth sort of appearance, even all of a larger piece of furniture. And that was a very long answer to a simple question, but that was kind of my approach. I don't know should I just keep going?
No. It's wonderful. But it's so interesting, because I feel like Rob Melrose, the artistic director, he has structured these seasons to include very filmic pieces. Like Last season, they had the Da Vinci Code. They just did Misery. I mean, it's all of these things that started not necessarily as plays. And I think that when we have plays, usually you just have like one or two locations. It's a very easy kind of set transition from one to the other. Usually it's very convenient. At Act Two, it changes, you know. But these film versions are just wild. And Michael Lochler, the guy that's over all of this stuff, it's just been amazing watching them handle this, because I'm like, how are you going to do this? Because have you counted how many locales do you have in this, or do you even know?
No, we have 8 scenes in Act One, and we have, I think, 9 scenes in Act Two. So yeah, that's, some of them are repetitive. So yeah, that's quite a bit. So that is actually the big, and for me, that's like the most fun part of my job, is trying to figure out how does, because, you know, it's sometimes easier to design a beautiful set for a single location, but then if you have 17 of them, how, and you know, they have to go very quick succession, how do you do that? And that's the challenge, that's the puzzle. Sometimes I feel like there's more drama off stage or under the stage, and hopefully not. Sorry, that was not, probably not the appropriate thing to say, but like, you know, if I sometimes wish people would see what actually happens off stage to make things happen, or underneath the stage, in our case with the toasters, not pop-ups, that you know, happens, you know, things have to be changed while they are still underneath the stage before they go up, and so forth. So that's the, I think, and also the filming, I think it adds the fast pace, because I think these days also people are used to very fast paced things. You know, we all watch Instagram, everything is like few seconds long. So I think also keeping up with that kind of, I think, adds to the sort of the thriller. And yeah, and I think in my own work, I always feel like, you know, when you see, yeah, on Thursday, we had the last time we see the actors rehearse in the rehearsal hall, and everything happens very quickly because there's no set. It's really people just helping you to the set, same, you know, setting, marking everything up. And I sometimes feel the energy should not drop just because something has to wait for the set. I want the set, you know, not to get in the way. I want the set to help tell the story, but not get in the way. So that's what I feel like, it's very important part of my job, is to help it tell it, but not get in the way of saying the story.
Yeah. Well, you've done Summer Chills before. You alluded to that. Is there a different approach that you take when a show is a thriller, as opposed to like maybe a bright, cheery musical or something like that? Did you like find yourself trying to figure out design elements that are going to make it seem a little bit more tense or create that suspense?
Yes, for sure. For sure. Especially this one. Or sometimes you can do the opposite. Sometimes, like, for example, with, well, actually both with Murder of Roger Ackroyd or with Lenny and Soprano, you walk into the theater and see very idyllic, beautiful interiors and very decorative. And then that's going to juxtaposition of like a really brutal murder happen there. So it's for in case of Richard, in Agatha Christie. So, It's with this piece, I kind of felt like I wanted to have, we are starting from the very beginning, I think I wanted to kind of have this sort of this little bit shifting reality, I should say. I'm using this material that I only used once before, and I was a little bit nervous. It's a polycarbonate, so it's a structurally very stable material. People built, you know, greenhouses out of it. I use it in bronze, so it's not too bright, so it can go dark. And what I like about the material is that you can see through it when you light through it, kind of, but also when you light in front of it, it turns into a mirror. And so we've been trying to figure out the right sort of the right version of how much do we want to see through. And that was the exciting part, sort of working with Michelle Fullerton, who is the head scenic artist. So she got the sample of the material, and I said, okay, maybe now it's too translucent, because maybe the director and I thought maybe it should be very opaque. And she kind of put a scenic treatment on one side, and then she sent us a video of somebody walking behind it, and it has this eerie kind of ghostly quality. And we're like, oh, that is amazing, amazing. So we thought that's what we're gonna go with. So sometimes I like is that I actually don't do any, I design the set, but I don't actually like literally don't touch anything that you audience comes and see. So I would say my design only looks as good as the people who produce it and who actually create it. And so for me, working with Michelle and her doing, oh my gosh, how many different samples we had to the different opacities, and because there are a series of sliding panels and we have memory pieces and people weaving through them, it was so important to get them the right opacity. And she, I don't know how many samples she did, but many, 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 and different colors. And then, of course, we, our director, Casey Stengel, she's like, you know, I want also the furniture to kind of be part of her world, because it's, we are in Rachel's head. This is, we are seeing what happened through Rachel's head. So since she is a substance abuser and unreliable narrator, it's not, every, nothing is that clear. We don't know exactly where things are, and it's kind of shifting. And so she's like, I want the furniture to be a little bit different. And so Scott Graw, who is the props master, he said, I can work with plastic. I mean, we can do something. I was like, goodness, that would be amazing. So he had this, those things, a great collaboration, because we said, I said, you know, this is the material, the polycarbonate. And he said, oh, that'd be a really cool, I think I can make it work, which is amazing. And then yesterday, I, you know, 2 days ago, I walked into the theater and the pieces are there and they look pretty cool. I mean, you know, I think they're, well, we'll see, but I think it's pretty exciting. And he said, you know, I just want to tell you, you saw this draw, is the drawings were there, but you know, I kind of feel like I needed to take some liberties, because this is like, I kind of felt this was really good. And I'm like, thank you. Exactly right. Because I love the collaboration, because sometimes, you know, my work ends with the construction drawings, but I'm not actually, and you know, sometimes when you make something with your hands, you can think of better ways to do it. And so I really appreciate really true collaborators who are the input to the design. And they're all designers. They have fine arts degrees. And so I really enjoy, that's one of the main thing I really love about theater, is working with people who are interested and really skilled and know what they're doing. It's just a joy to be able to do that.
Well, it's amazing to think of how many people in the process, especially when you bring something this technical to the stage, and how many people have to like pass that baton off and execute something very different. And you, I'm so excited because you, I think you're the only person, Clara, that I've heard use the word opacity in an interview. It's really awesome. But I was going to ask you about your own journey too. Obviously, you're very well known for Jersey Boys, Tony nominated for that. But how did you get into scenic design? Like, what was the genesis of this for you?
You know, I always enjoyed arts. My first degree was in book culture and typography. I grew up in Prague in the Czech Republic. And yeah, and you know, I grew up behind the Iron Curtain when the, I'm dating myself here, but let be it. And yeah, I done some sculpture as well. I worked on the expo 100 years ago in Japan, and when I was still a teenager, and I sort of enjoyed three-dimensional work always. And when I wanted to do a study abroad for a year, it kind of happened to be in a drama school in theater design. And I thought, oh, how different can it be? You know, but it's, I never work with a story really. And so the first time working with a story, and that's kind of, it's all about what we are doing, right? The storytelling through actors, through speaking and moving me through visual means, and sort of really, really fell in love with that. I was pretty lucky that after after college, I was able to work for Ming Cho Lee, one of the sort of preeminent designers in the United States. And Tony Walton as well. And they, you know, obviously a big Broadway designer, and they were both very supportive of my career and encouraging. And my parents didn't, you know, say, oh, she will never make a living. That's always a story. It's only like a parent's dream for a kid go to theater, because obviously, but you know, we're having a lot of fun. So there's a price you pay for everything, maybe. So I really truly love what I do. And I feel like every project is new and different, different materials, different group of people, different director, different approach. And so that's why for me, it never gets old.
Yeah, never boring.
Never boring.
And it's funny, because when I think back to Jersey Boys, I really feel like that was a musical that had a very filmic quality to it. So you being on The Girl on the Train and this connection of the cinematic feel, it makes sense in this weird way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I actually started, because I'm from Central Europe, I thought I'm going to do tragedies and everything very dark. And
yes.
I had this notion of American musical as being too frivolous or, you know, not for me. And then as more I learned about the genre, the more respect I have, huge respect for the genre and how difficult it is and how difficult it is to do it well. And so with Jersey Boys being my first big Broadway musical, I didn't even have a full script. It was work in development and it was super exciting, really fast paced, and obviously a huge success. And everybody thought, oh, I am I'm the woman who can, I'm the designer who can do all these fast pace. And I love it, to be honest. I love it. And I am, I don't remember getting a script in my hand that didn't have like a million different scenes in different locations. So I really enjoy the technical part of my work as well. I love the, you know, I love working with the technical directors and here, you know, Paul Zappone and D.W. Jones, they were just the best, and being able to collaborate with them, and they're so smart and they can make so many amazing things happen. I really have huge respect and take so much joy out of working with people like that. But you are right. I love the puzzle. I love the technical puzzle, to be honest. Yeah.
Well, what's it like working here at the Alley? I mean, obviously you've been here a couple of times, but what is it like coming here? What keeps you coming back?
Well, it's the people. Really, yeah. It's the people and what they do, what they stand for. I think it's the theater that's really pretty amazing and unique. There are a lot of great theaters in the United States, but this is definitely one of the very best. And I feel like they're doing it well. I think they have a lot of pride in their work. They treat people well. I think that's a lot to be said for people who come here as artists. I think that's what keeps me coming back. And also, as I mentioned before, like working with people who are so good at what they do, and they have the yes, we can do mentality. So on this show, I love built-in lights. I feel like I'm the queen of built-in lights, everything that lights up that on the set. And I usually, to be honest, over design a little bit because I'm ready to be having make some cuts budgetarily. And on this show with the director, because I was talking about the shifting reality and the train passing by and trying to create a sense of movement, we thought we will use, and I designed a lot of LED lights, and I thought it's going to get cut and they're all there. So I was told that we have 1,200 linear feet of LED lights. So I haven't seen them all turned on yet, but I think it's going to be quite spectacular. So I really look forward to it.
I'm so excited about this. I'm always excited about the tech. I am such a geek when it comes to that. So, Clara Zieglerova, thank you so much for talking to me about The Girl on the Train. One of the summer chills, going to be July 24th through August 30th at the Alley. So a nice summer run here, a chance to get into the air conditioning and see, 12,000 LED lights? Is that what we're looking at?
1,200. You know, 1,200? I said, what are you talking about? 1,200. But 1,200. Still, it's still a lot.
It's a lot. And opaque things and things that turn solid and they become mirrors and all of that.
Yes.
Yeah, we're excited about it. Yeah, so thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Queer Voices on KPFT Houston, and we are also a podcast available from all major digital outlets. We have a legacy here in Houston in that we have been on the air in some form or fashion for over 5 decades. As long as KPFT has been around in Houston. But this station is listener-funded. To help us, please consider donating to KPFT at kpft.org. You can make a one-time contribution or, like me, set up a monthly one. And if you would like to be a part of Queer Voices, please look me up on social media. My name is Brett, with 2 T's, Cullum. My last name is spelled only with U's as vowels. We would love to include your voice here, either as a guest or as a regular contributor. Kind of like the donation, but in your time. And it can be one time or ongoing, just like that donation. We'll take your money or your voice. We are not picky here at Queer Voices. And if you just enjoy listening, that's great too. Hi there, this is Brett Cullum. The Montrose Center will host the 2nd annual LGBTQ+ Independent Author Fair to be held on Saturday, August 1st. It's going to last from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. Two of the featured artists at this event are author Arlie Ingalls and poet and artist Stelina Villarreal, who are with me today. So welcome, Lee and Stelina.
Thank you.
Hello.
Glad to be here.
Likewise.
Hi there. Well, what I wanted to find out first is a little bit about what you write and what you are showcasing in this event. So, Stelina, can you tell me a little bit about your book and what you are bringing to this author fair?
Yes. So my book, it's Spanglish, which means to watch. It's a book about art. And I went to a bunch of art exhibits and wrote about them. And also it's in English and Spanish. but I focused a lot on the artist issues that I wrote about, and a lot of the artists are part of the LGBTQIA community. And so I wrote, for example, about being trans and being non-binary, but as well as being a lesbian. I also have some flash nonfiction that introduces the poem sections. And there I talk a little about my life and my relationship to art. And I talk about being queer in some of those as well. And so, and then the Spanish uses a lot of what's called inclusive language, el lenguaje inclusivo, which basically means that it's gender neutral when referring to people, but it's still gendered when referring to inanimate objects.
Oh, wow. Oh, very, very interesting. And then Lee, your books are a little bit different, obviously.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what you're bringing.
Yeah, my area of interest is capturing history, the history of people, and not just any people, but those people that normally don't get written about. So being part of the Ingalls family, I think that's a legacy that Laura began, and I wanted to continue. So the first book that I wrote added a fourth generation of stories about the Ingalls family, and then my second book added a fifth generation. The second book is actually my stories. It's a different audience for each one of the books. So where the first book might have been for those that were fan of the TV series and Laura's books, my second book would be more for an audience that we are accustomed to, the gay and lesbian community, because it does. It chronologues the growing up of a gay man mid-1900s in the upper Midwest, in a time where we didn't have access to all the broadcast TV and the social media and the internet and those things that we have today. So it was an interesting time to grow up. And I want to make sure that I capture that. And then another interest is cooking. My family put together a recipe book a long time ago, but it was too big. So I pared it down to those recipes that I actually make and put it in a book form as well. I also have short stories and stuff out there talking about other things also. So yeah, it's about the history of the Ingalls family largely, but I think that that also captures the history of average Americans.
So you both write about identity and cultural ancestry and different things, viewpoints from that. So it'd be interesting, but very different projects and very different viewpoints, which is the beauty of having one of these author fairs, is you get a lot of different variety. But tell me kind of how you started writing. Like, Selena, if you could tell me like how you decided that you were going to write this book called Watcha.
Well, mine didn't start intentionally. I took an art history class when I was doing my PhD program at University of Houston. And the art history class went to Mexico City and we looked at a bunch of art exhibits. The professor said, for those of you who are in graduate studies, you have to write something related to your dissertation. And I just thought about it and asked, well, can I write some poems about the art? And the professor said yes. So initially my book Watcha did have some poems about Mexico, but I ended up taking them out because most of the poems were about US-based Latinx artists, including Afro-Latinx artists, and I also have a few indigenous artists. But because it was US-based, because a lot of the ethnic identities of the artists were not of Mexican origin, I took out the poems that had to do with the Mexican art. But that's how it started. It just also so happened that when I was working on the project, there was something called Latino Art Now, which happens every 2 years in a different city, and it happened in Houston around that time. It basically brings awareness to Latinx art. Because as an anthropologist, Arlene Davila, has expressed, Latin American art gets a lot of visibility, but Latinx art doesn't get as much visibility. And so I wanted to bring that visibility in the book.
And Lee, yours is a different path, correct? Not as academic.
Yeah. Mine is totally different. However, the process that we use sounds like it's very similar, because I've always believed in, when you write something, don't think about what you're writing or whether or not you should include something or how you should include it, etc. Put everything down that comes to mind, because the book really takes shape in the editing, not in the initial draft. So I just write to write. And when I'm done, I'm done. And then I go back and start editing and try to make a book out of it.
But you both have physical copies of your book that you're bringing along to this author fair, obviously. Right. So you've been published. So I want to talk to you about the paths that you both took to being published. And Lee, if you could start us off with how you got your book out there.
Yeah, so that's a great question. I did talk to a lot of literary agents and publishing houses, et cetera, about publishing my book. But one of the things I found interesting, if you use, people are going to hate me for saying this, especially those in the literary world, printing world. A lot of times they want to edit your book so that it's more marketable and more of whatever they think it should be. And I really was not interested in that. I wanted my books to remain purely my voice. So to do that, you have to go down the road of self-publishing, or I felt I did. That's why I chose to do self-publishing, rather than using an agent or a publishing house.
Selena, I know your book is available on your website, which is just your name, selenavillarreal.com, but it looks like it's published through another channel.
Yes, it's published by Deep Vellum Publishing. And I actually went the traditional route that poets go, and I actually submitted to contests and open reading periods. One of the contests I applied to, the Noemi Press one, my book was a finalist, but they decided not to publish it. I didn't win, but it got recognition. And when I posted about it online, one of my friends, who is a pressmate from a literary translation press that I'm a part of, because I'm also a literary translator, they saw that I had become a finalist and said, "Oh, well, have you introduced your work to Develum?" And I said no, and I asked, "Well, can you introduce me to the editor?" And they said yes. And at the time, the editor, Sebastian Paramo, he is someone who is completely bilingual, and so he was actually the perfect audience member for my book, since he was able to understand all of it. And because he was just so supportive of the inclusive language and all the content. And so it was a really great experience to work with him. But again, poets don't use an agent, but I still sort of needed a little bit of a push from a press in order to be recognized and to be seen.
Yeah, very different things going around an author versus a poet. Like when you're working with a historical book versus a book about poetry and art. So it's interesting that you both kind of have different paths. But what I wanted to ask you too is, how important is community as an author or an artist? Is this event, are you looking forward to meeting other independent authors in the LGBTQ space?
I think that's very important too, for people to see you and to know you and see your work, and how does that relate to them? You know, where can they find themselves in your work, et cetera. I think it's very important. I'm looking forward to this event.
Definitely. You don't create art in a vacuum. It's community as a part of it. So I think meeting other artists and writers are integral to what I do as my process. And when I go to book fairs, what's dangerous is that I end up with more books than what I come in with, because I end up buying some of them. But I'm looking forward to meeting all the writers who are part of the book fair. I love that it's intimate, unlike some of the book fairs that have just so many authors that you can't really talk to them that much. I'm really looking forward to be able to have a conversation and to see how we overlap and how we also are a diverse community as well.
Of course, we're talking about the Houston LGBTQ plus Independent Author Fair, which is going to be at the Montrose Center Saturday, August 1st. And I wanted to ask both of you how you fit into the community. So, Selena, I noticed that you use she, they pronouns. So how did you arrive at that designation and how do you identify?
So I am intersex. I have hyperandrogenism. So that just means that I have too much androgen for a woman. So for many years, I identified as a manly woman without having the vocabulary to understand what that meant. for many years, I didn't understand the umbrella of what it is to be trans until more recently when the non-binary label came up and I started to understand it a little bit more. And I don't identify as non-binary, but I think I'm closer to someone who is non-binary than someone who is on one of the ends of the binary. And so I think that it was a long process. So I do identify as trans, but the book actually came out before I came out as trans. So what you see in there is me talking about being queer and just celebrating, again, artists who I was able to live through vicariously. And I was able to write about trans issues before I realized, okay, I'm trans too.
Well, do you think that creating this book, Watcha, helped you define that for yourself?
Definitely. I thought that looking at what the artists were expressing and what I was expressing were one and the same. I thought that it really helped me. Even, for example, the poem about being lesbian, because I've dated men, I'm not a lesbian, but I have a partner who's a woman. And so now I'm lesbian for her. And so I feel like it does encompass all of my identities. And I have tried to go through different LGBTQ acronyms, trying to find myself. For a while, I was questioning. And I didn't like that people thought of people who are questioning as young because I'm middle-aged. But I felt like I identified with that Q because I had tried different ones. I thought I was bisexual for a while. Then I thought I was pansexual for a while. And now I'm demisexual. So I really have a broad spectrum that I tried through the acronyms. And I really like that trans is a nice umbrella where I can fit.
Well, and Lee, how do you identify?
Yeah, so I'm a gay guy. I mean, I've always been that. That's just who I am. There was really never any question, even before I knew that that term existed or that that community existed. I knew that's who I was. I just couldn't have articulated it the way that I do today. So yeah, no, totally gay.
Well, I think that you both have this journey that you've documented with your work, because Delina, obviously you were talking about queer representation, and Lee, obviously you've written a book about your coming up as a gay man and figuring out that you are. So a little bit of similarity there, although different paths, for sure. But how much does history and cultural identity play into your work? And I would love to ask Lee first. You know, obviously you come from a very historied family, so you've got to feel this weight of like a historical legacy too.
Yeah, so I do. My family's history is well documented, and you would expect the Ingalls side. Certainly, you would expect it to be a lot of information there, and there is. There are museums, there are libraries, there are books written about our family. There's a lot of information out there about that side of my family, but it would be surprising to know that there's almost as much about my mother's family as well. In fact, today I wrote a short article about one of my ancestors that was born in the 1600s, the first generation of that side of my family to be born in the New World, as they knew it back then. I do history and family history. My own personal is very important to me, but it's also important for me to encourage other people to look inside their own family histories to find those stories that are remarkable. We all have them in our family. And if we don't tell them, then they fade into history and nobody ever thinks about them again. And I think it's a shame to lose that part of your own connection to your past. So yeah, that's my motivation. Yeah. And I think Selena made a very good point. When you write something, whether that's about you or about something or about somebody else, it changes who you are and becomes a part of who you are. You understand that experience better, or you write about something that even that you might have thought of in your own personal life. But then once you write about it, you really see it more clearly than you did before, and it changes who you are. So writing, I think, is important.
Yeah, and Selena, kind of the same question. I mean, how much does cultural identity play into your work?
Well, cultural identity is a big part of who I am. And so, for example, the fact that I did focus on a very Latinx-based book and also a book that included a large part of my queerness, I decided to write about my family history a little bit as well. My mother was an activist. Her name was Maria Jimenez. And she really shaped who I am. And I write a little bit about my family history, how I'm fourth generation immigrant in Magnolia Park. And also, I wrote a little bit about politics because the book starts off with what I call rebuttal poems, where I write a little bit about what other people say about the subject, but then I insert toward the end my own opinion, whereas the end of the book is very political and definitely protest poetry. And I also write a little bit about my family history in those prose sections because I talk about how being political and art are in conversation with one another.
Well, Selena, how did you find out about this book fair?
I was recommended by John Marullo's partner for some reason. And I think it's because they're friends with Kuma, who is a great activist and artist in town. And I think that that's how it happened. But it was through recommendations.
Yeah, they've been on the show a couple of times. So, yes, very familiar. And Lee, how did you get involved initially with the author fair?
Yeah, so John recommended me last year, reached out to me last year. And I'm not exactly sure how he found out who I am or where I am or how to contact me. But he reached out to me last year. We participated last year and I look forward to it this year as well.
Yeah, what did you find last year was like for you?
You know, it was new for everybody. It was the first year that they did that. So it was a smaller author group, but it was very well attended. I met a lot of people. And like Selena said, you end up buying more books than what you intend to when you walk through the door. But that's okay. That gets you to know the local authors as well. So, yeah, I was very pleased. I sold a lot of books, had a lot of conversations, met a lot of people. Some of the people I still talk to today.
Yeah, unfortunately, Selena, I agree with you as well. I walked out of the author fair last year with more books than I think I filled up a whole shelf. But it's so interesting because you really do get a chance to see people from every facet of the community. And it's an intimate, like you said, Selena, it's not a huge author fair. It's not a ton of people. It's enough that you can walk through, talk to people, find out exactly what they're doing, just like we are doing today, which I appreciate both of you for doing that. But it's the second annual Houston LGBTQ plus Independent Author Fair, Montrose Center, Saturday, August 1st from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. And of course, you can meet author Arlie Ingalls and poet and artist Selena Villarreal. They will be there and have their books available, and it'll be a great event. So thank you both for talking to me about it.
Thank you.
All right, this is Queer Voices, and I am Matthew Williams, and a part of another installment in our series of talking to people doing great things in the community and also finding out what makes them happy today. I have a very, very fun interview for y'all. Petroleum engineer, Texas Aggie, Rice MBA, actor, producer, community builder, champion of South Asian stories, founder of Aerial Roots Theater, the guy who spends his days in the energy industry and his nights under the stage lights, proof that engineers can in fact have dramatic flair, living proof that spreadsheets and Shakespeare can coexist, the man who found love at Texas A&M, found his artistic calling in Houston, and apparently one gay brother wasn't enough. His family said, let's overachieve. Please welcome Tahir Lokhandwala.
Wow. That is a great intro. Yes. I don't think I'm ever going to be
the best car salesman
as long as I live.
That's plan.
Great. Thank you for having me, Matt.
Yes, no problem. That's the plan. So, yes, we have Mr. Tahir here to talk to us about a nice little endeavor. I always tell people Houston has a ton of arts, way more than even people in the arts realize. So we got a new theater company coming to us. I'm going to let you go ahead and explain a little bit the name of it and what you're doing.
Yeah. So the name of the company is Aerial Roots Theater Company. My co-founders and myself, Anjana Menon and Nidhi Verghese, we met in the Houston theater scene, doing what we love. It is, the name of the company is synonymous with the banyan tree that's found all over South Asia. And it has these roots that come out of its branches and root into the ground. And they make the central trunk of the tree stronger. But the tree also kind of spreads and propagates. And we thought that was a great metaphor for the South Asian diaspora and the immigrant community at large, which is such a big part of the fabric of Houston, Texas, right? Like you spread out and propagate out of many times of your homeland, but in doing so, you strengthen not just yourselves, but your home country. And so our mission is, we put it in a simple way, to tell stories that speak to the South Asian diaspora experience and for the people that love us. So it's not just for us, but it's for this vibrant community of Houston we call home. And yeah, we have our first show, A Nice Indian Boy, which speaks to just that experience, opening at the Asia Society July 31st. And I'm super excited to bring that to the theater community and to the Houston community at large.
Yeah. And speaking of the play, what about it? Because it's, you know, it's kind of, it's a bit of a funny play, not, at least some comedy involved. But what about it made you say that this needs to be the first one?
Yeah, it's a rom-com. In many ways, it is a story that I'm very close to as a queer Indian American person. It is about the relationships that we have here within the gay community and within the queer community, but it also speaks to the immigrant experience and how a lot of times folks who raise kids who grow up here who are very different from their parents can find it troubling to bridge the gap between generations. But it's a real story about how love can conquer difference, how love can bridge a lot of these gaps. And so it's really touching and very sweet in many ways, but also super funny. And yeah, hopefully a great night at the theater for queer people in Houston, for the immigrant community, and really for everyone. It's a very universal story.
You know, considering, so full disclosure to everybody listening, I know Tahir because of his brother Hussein that I've been close with for a few years now. And it's such an interesting story because I'm pretty sure he's brought up you being involved in theater some. Yeah. But then one day he was just like, yeah, you're starting a theater company. I was like, oh, but I did what now? What? Because I know, you know, the fields that you work in. I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting in a great way, in a very great way. So I love those kind of stories. One thing I think interesting question I want to ask you is, what would you think an 18-year-old version of you would say about where you're at now?
I hope the 18-year-old version would sort of look at where I am now and be proud. 18-year-old me was just leaving India, moving to America to build a life and a career here, and had starry-eyed dreams and thoughts of a life not lived and friends not had yet and partners not met yet. Notice I said partners. Yeah, we are gay men after all. But yeah, I've you know, looking back as now late 30s, and I won't say more, a person, I hope I would, you know, building the life I've built with a partner who I love very much, a job that I enjoy doing, and a passion that I'm pursuing with Aerial Roots, that my 18-year-old self would be like, yeah, all right, you know, some of the stars in my eyes, maybe they were real. A loving gay relationship that's long-term is possible and achievable. I don't think that 18-year-old me had that. And so I think maybe would be surprised from that perspective, but I think hopefully also really hopeful to see that that was a possibility.
Yeah, yeah. I got two more questions, and I'm going to go in the opposite direction now. 5 years from now, what do you hope someone says after they walk out of an Aerial Roots production?
Wow, that's an ambitious question. So my short-term and our short-term goals as a co-founding team are, we want to be, South Asians are not a very highly represented community in the arts. And so we want to tell stories for South Asian audiences, like I said, and the people that love us, but like we would love the chance to pay South Asian artists to make art. Like that is something that we hope to achieve and do so by creating a vibrant community, shows that people want to come out and watch, and make a sustainable infrastructure for ourselves. And so that, I hope, is a goal that we can achieve in the next 2 years, if not the next five. In the next five, I mean, like, I would hope to be like a Houston institutional theater, that I would hope to be a destination theater company for folks looking for a evening that of thought-provoking entertainment, of art that speaks to them and their experiences. as Houstonians, as, you know, people of all creeds, sexualities, genders. And I hope to be, or we as a founding team, hope to be able to provide that to the city that we love so much.
Yeah, yeah. That sounds like a great plan to me. And my last question, the one that I have to ask everybody, is what gives you hope today?
I think it has always been the people around me. I think every moment with my partner, with my mother-in-law in our home, the life that we're building, my friends, talking to people like yourself, I'm always like moved by the goodness and the amazingness that people do. Like, I mean, look at you, right? Like all of the amazing things you do in local politics, with this podcast, with your job, with your creativity. I mean, how can you like not enter a conversation like this and leave inspired?
Yeah, I mean, that's the point. That's the point. Yeah. I hate complaining, and I hate complaining without doing anything about it. And also, yeah, it just feels good. So, I don't know, people who don't do that, you have fun with life, but it just, you know, kind of feels good to look for hope and aim for it. And I guess coming from the arts, you know, maybe it's like a big thing in the arts, even if the saddest of saddest stories still has some kind of way to give you a little bit of hope. So we'll go ahead and start to end the interview now. But the last thing I want to end with is you letting us know all the information that you want our listeners to know about, where to find out about Nice Indian Boy, how to see it, where it's at, and then any information about future productions.
Amazing. Yeah. So A Nice Indian Boy is going to be at the Asia Society. It's in the Museum District. It's a beautiful space at the Brown Theater. Asia Society has been a wonderful partner, and want to shout out particularly Chelsea D'Souza and her team there at Asia Society for all of the help that they've provided us in putting the show on. The show runs from July 31st to August 9th. It's 8 shows. I have an exciting offer, Matt, for your listeners. Okay. If they use the code PARTNER10, they can get $10 off any ticket that they purchase between now and August 9th. That's PART, P-A-R-T-N. It's $10 off a $35 ticket price. So we want to make sure it's an affordable show for everyone to come watch. And we hope that they will take advantage of that. As for coming shows, you'll have to stay tuned. Follow us on Aerial Roots HTX on Instagram.
All right. Well, thank you very much for taking some time out to talk about your endeavor and the play and the production company and everything, the theater company and whatnot. I'm definitely going to be at one of these productions. My schedule finally changed in a great way, so I'm definitely going to be at one of these to tell everybody about. Well, I'm already telling everybody about it, but I definitely can't wait to see it, to tell even more people about the experience. But I want to say thank you again for this. My name is Matthew Williams. I'm speaking with Tahir Lokhandwala, founder of Aerial Roots Theater Company. And y'all make sure to check out Nice Indian Boy. I said that right. Yeah.
You did. Thank you so much.
Yeah, yeah. So thank you again. Thank you again. And this is Career Voices.
This has been Queer Voices, heard on KPFT Houston and as a podcast available from several podcasting sources. Check our webpage, queervoices.org, for more information. Queer Voices executive producer is Brian Levinka. Deborah Moncrief Bell is co-producer. Brett Cullum and David Mendoza Drusman are contributors. The News Wrap segment is part of another podcast called This Way Out, which is produced in Los Angeles.
Some of the material in this program has been edited to improve clarity and runtime. This program does not endorse any political views or animal species. Views, opinions, and endorsements are those of the participants and the organizations they represent. In case of death, please discontinue use and discard remaining products.
For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. At the Holiday Inn Express and Suites in Los Alamos, New Mexico, the windows themselves generate electricity. But guests are unaware it's happening.
The beauty of our technology is that it doesn't look any different than a regular window.
Hunter McDaniel is founder and CEO of Ubiquity, the company that developed the windows. They're made with what are called quantum dots, tiny particles that absorb sunlight and convert it into a glow outside the visible spectrum of light. That glow is then routed to solar cells at the edge of the window. The hotel windows are part of a pilot project, and the technology is not yet commercially available. But McDaniel expects to start selling the windows this year. He says they're an ideal solution for urban areas.
If you go to a city and you look around, there's nowhere to put solar panels. On the rooftops, there's HVAC systems, leisure spaces.
And the roofs are small compared to the height of the building.